Awesome, like podcasts and stuff?
I've seen people with podcasts less desperate for approval.
I hope this isn't about your podcast again.
Please, podcasts are verbal narcissism for ugly journalists.
Welcome to the Awful Announcing Podcast. Here's your host, Ben Heisler.
Welcome in, everybody. This is episode number 21 of the Awful Announcing Podcast, presented by the good folks over at Clip It, the number one way to share your favorite clips with your family and friends. Download the Clip It app today on iOS and on Android. Ben Heisler here. I'll be joined in just a minute by Taylor Twellman of ESPN, the outstanding worldwide leader soccer analyst. He's also a terrific artist. If you've had a chance to watch him during the segments on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt for Draw the World Cup, really have been waiting for a good opportunity to talk to Taylor, and he was available this week. We're taping this on a Wednesday, so we didn't get into any sort of finals preview with England and Croatia still yet to play at the time of us taping the podcast, but really got into a spirited conversation about the U.S. men's national team, his start in soccer, and his perspective as a four-sport athlete, really sort of shaping his worldview. We also got into a little hot take culture and how sometimes he's thrown into the mix, but how he tries to balance it and be completely honest in the process. And I think as you get to listen and hear Taylor out, you'll notice that he's not about hot take culture at all. He is about being as forthright and as upfront as possible. And he says what's on his mind and also is willing to admit when his opinions have changed on something. So we got into all of that with Taylor. Really looking forward to that conversation and to be able to share that with you guys. But before we do that, it's time for our game. It's time for you, the listener, to have a chance to win a prize just for following us on Twitter at Awful Announcing and having a general sense of who's coming up on our podcast today. You got to identify two clips on our game for your chance to win. And today we are talking to Brendan in Columbus, Ohio. What's up, Brendan? How are you?
Doing pretty good. Ready to go.
Perfect. So you know how the game is played?
Yes, okay. I'm well aware.
Very good. All right, so I'm going to give you clip number one. And again, our game is presented by the good folks over at Clip It. This first clip, Brendan, I need you to name this host of ESPN's new talk show, explaining that Stephen A. Smith maybe does have some level of credibility. Take a listen.
I love it. Stephen A., it is important to know because there are some young people, speaking of our very cool audience, there are some young people who don't necessarily appreciate that Stephen A. is, in fact, plugged in.
Yeah.
So whether or not this is true, I have no idea. All I do know, though, is that I was watching that wedding video that Dwayne Wade and Gabrielle Union put out from their nuptials. In the crowd was Stephen A. Smith wearing black ties. So the man is many, many places, but this is mostly that uncut good.
It's been a show that has taken off over the last month or so. Can you tell me this ESPN broadcaster that says, you know what, Stephen A. Smith, for as much as he talks, might actually be in the know?
I have not really watched this show yet, I can admit, but I am going to take a stab at the voice. Is that Tony Reale?
Well, you know what? He has filled in on Tony Reale's show on Around the Horn several times. The voice you were actually hearing was that of Pablo Torre. The co-host of High Noon.
I don't think I would have got that. I feel all right.
All right, you still have a chance. For $25 to Amazon.com. Next clip, Brendan, I need you to tell me it is a Fox soccer announcer during the World Cup. He was also a former U.S. World Cup star. And a lot of fans thought he was actually Troy Aikman because their voices are so similar. Tell me which Fox announcer this is that is a Troy Aikman accidental impersonator. Take a listen.
Well, there's reason to believe Diego Maradona, as Lionel Messi, just when you needed him, found a way to unlock this defense on an outstanding ball by Ever Banega. Look at the touch. Look at the weight of the pass. Messi puts it in his path and buries it to the far post. What a great touch. Set up and shot by Lionel Messi.
All right, Brendan, I didn't hear it the first time, but when I go back and listen to it again, I gotta say, he's a Troy Aikman impersonator at its finest. Can you name the Fox soccer announcer?
He does sound like Troy Aikman. The sad part is I have no idea who this is, but I've watched that entire game. Oh my God, this is gonna kill me. Man, I don't know.
That's all right. It was Tony Meola. Tony Meola was your answer. Oh, Brendan, what a bummer.
I know. you know, thanks for having me on, though. I got to pay a little more attention to who's actually talking. And you know what I mean? That's the moral of the story here.
Well, there you go. I appreciate you listening to the Awful Announcing Podcast and for playing our game. No, not a winner today, but you never know. Maybe come back, have an opportunity for a redemption tour. Thanks so much for your time, Brennan. Have a good rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
So, just like the U.S. men's national team, our pal Brendan in Columbus swung and missed. And now there will be an opportunity. Maybe it'll be 4 years later. Hopefully it'll be a little bit less than that for him to have a chance to totally redeem himself. As we go and move on to our feature guest here on the Awful Announcing Podcast, Taylor Twellman really has been the face of American soccer for the last several years. He's been an outstanding World Cup analyst and the summer intern on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt. He was a longtime player and forward for the New England Revolution, also played 30 matches for the U.S. men's national team. An outstanding match and studio analyst for ESPN's coverage of both national and international soccer, as Taylor Twellman joins us now. Taylor, first of all, congratulations on the completion of your summer internship on SportsCenter with Scott Van Pelt. any rumor to them extending a full-time job offer to both draw and analyze soccer now that this internship's complete?
No, I have a sneaky suspicion when Scott Van Pelt and his crew turn in my review that I may never be asked back, but whatever.
I really enjoyed it. And for anyone who wants a little bit of behind the scenes of Draw the World Cup, Jacob Feldman wrote a really good article about it, because I think why it worked, Taylor, there's just such a good mix. You had the major soccer fans who had been watching all the games in the morning and the early afternoon, getting key analysis, and then you had the fans who were simply tuning in and wanted to find some fun with ESPN's World Cup coverage, and you had a really good mix of both. So what were those original conversations like with production when you guys were trying to figure out what direction you wanted to go for World Cup coverage on that
show?
Well,
we didn't. It's actually a good question. So we didn't know about the highlights literally until the World Cup started. So we had assumed here at ESPN that we would be given the same amount that Fox, that we gave other networks in 2014. So we didn't find out until the opening day that we didn't have full rights. Like, and what I mean by full rights is like 60-70% more time. So credit to Scott sitting in the meeting with them. He's like, you know what? Why don't we draw? I think I'm going to have my daughter draw the games. And that's how it started. And you're right. Jacob did a real good job in Sports Illustrated of illustrating those meetings, because I wasn't in that meeting because I was doing another SportsCenter hit when they made that decision. So I walked in, and I think they were a little, for lack of a better word, timid to see how I would take it. And I never took it negative, because the way Scott does his shows, he was obviously going to take the analysis of the games part serious.
Right.
It wasn't as if he was going to make a joke of the sport and whatnot. But he wanted to make a point about the lack of highlights, and I thought it was an ingenious idea, but that was all off the cuff. Like, we didn't, you know, there wasn't, oh, I'm going to say this, you're going to say this. He said, you know what? And so the first time I saw the picture and the idea was actually live on the show. And then in my mind, I was like, you know what? I should draw. Now, obviously, you know, the line was, I draw better than your daughter. She's five. But besides the point, Ben, it was all organic. It was real. There was nothing contrived. There was nothing, you know, there was no script or anything. We just did it. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it.
I mean, you really got into drawing. Like, did you practice at all? When was the last time you actually really sat down and drew something?
Well, first off, the last time I went to, you know, a drugstore and bought, you know, 45 or whatever crayons I bought, markers, that was a first. And even the checkout clerk looked at me and was like, what are you doing? I was like, don't ask. Just watch it on SportsCenter every night. I don't know, Ben. That's a good question. I think when I looked at it, I said, oh, I could do movie quotes. And so when you look at the progression of my drawing, at the beginning it was stick figures and I'm going to be clever with quotes. And my whole goal when doing this was to get Scott to laugh. And I said, I will do this, but Scott can't see my photos until we're live on TV. And that was the best part. So Scott hadn't seen the photos until I flip them up and show him. And the 4, 5, 6, 7 times that I got him to either spit, bite his bottom lip, chuckle, I mean, that for me was priceless. That was worth it all. You know, my rendition of Luis Suarez to this day is his avatar pick. So my drawings turned from stick figures, that thing, and then it came into, well, I could have themes. So when England beat Colombia in penalty kick shootout, I actually traced and drew the Ghostbusters symbol. So, you know, that's how that came about. But initially, I was a little nervous because I'm like, oh my goodness, there's going to be a lot of stick figures. I need to get a little bit more creative.
It was great. And like I said before, it was really creative, and I love the organic flow to it. And listen, anytime you can get Scott to laugh on his own show, I mean, he knows the value of it, bringing on Tim Kirchin once a week and getting him to wheeze uncomfortably just by dropping a Baltimore reference.
Yep.
So I thought it was great television. As far as the World
Cup... it was real. That's why it worked, I think.
I think,
you know, Scott is one of those very few people that make you feel like you're sitting at a bar, even though there's three cameras and we both got makeup on. You know, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
As far as the actual World Cup goes itself, I want to start sort of on this American perspective on it. And I'm looking at it from a whole a few weeks later, and to me it sort of feels like there was a bit of a blessing in the U.S. team not making it to Russia, because, and I'm sure you know this better than anyone, when Americans watch these type of events, whether it be the Olympics or the World Cup, they tend to get very nationalistic. They put on these red, white, and blue lens, and that sort of takes up all of their focus. To me, it opened up so much more of the brilliance of how soccer's played on the international level, more so than in World Cups past, especially early on. Did it feel that way to you at all?
No. To be honest with you, Ben, I think you could be further from the truth. And I say that honestly because, and here's why I'm going to say that. You look at it as a blessing. You tell me how is it a blessing? It is a punch right in the face, isn't it, that the United States in 2018, with the millions of dollars in player development and youth soccer and coaching and players and leagues and all of that stuff, and the United States still can't qualify. So this negative thing about the patriotic, you know, where you're 100% right is, yes, the Joe college football fan would only tune in every 4 years. So I can guarantee you there's 30-40% of sports fans that tuned into the World Cup this year go, wait, where's the United States? Who do they play?
Right.
They didn't even know they didn't qualify. So that's where you're right. But to say it's positive, I just can't see it. I just can't see the trees through the forest on that, because when I really look at it, it is a punch right between the eyes of reminding everyone that the United States has a lot to do in order to compete at this level.
I think that's a perfectly fair point, and I think it was more so to the point of more Americans being able to witness international soccer at its finalists sort of on their own main stage. I'm with you. I think as an American soccer fan, it's absolutely a gut punch. You feel like the opportunity to at least qualify should have absolutely been there. I'm with you there 100%.
Ben, to your point, though, if your team in your backyard is not competing, then you're not invested. So don't tell me, like, Joe college football fan cares about Croatia.
Right.
He's not going to care about Croatia. He cares if his team's in there. That's what makes it, you know, and I use the college football analogy, but your alma mater, that's what, even if your alma mater goes 3-10, they're still invested.
Sure.
You're not invested. I think the World Cup changed in 2010. I think the way this sport was viewed, I think the way this sport was, the exposure given to the fans that you're talking about, I actually think that your conversation you're having right now was in 2010. And I believe that's where this sport changed. The amount of people that are exposed to soccer now in 2018 is exponentially higher than it was 8 years ago. And the conversations you can have now with sports fans that you couldn't have 8 years ago is because the sport has been, it came out in 2010 in South Africa. It doubled down with a World Cup that was in prime time. And then to your point, I think a small percentage of it is a breath of fresh air that the amount of attention paid to the World Cup without the United States in it is at some level. But you're not going to get me to say it's a positive thing. And two, I think what you're saying is the exact feeling I had in 2010, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And I'll have to work on being 8 years not too late to the party from here on out. But
I don't mean it that way. I'm still having conversations with, and I love to death, but Mike Greenberg still wants to argue with me about penalties being the right situation to end a game. we're still having those kinds of conversations. So I'm not saying it's completely transformed. And Greeny and I have had some hysterical conversation about it. We've had fun about it. He does it, I think, some of it tongue-in-cheek.
Sure.
So you're still having those conversations. But those kinds of conversations were more prevalent in 2010. And I think 2010 showed the American sports world, this sport on the international level is unique. It's awesome. It's eerily similar to the Olympics. And then you can buy in, even if the United States are not there. But the investment of that fan, I'm sorry, Ben, I'm going to say it's 10, 20, 30 times bigger if the United States was competing in this World Cup.
I think the investment from the fans would absolutely be there. And I'll actually fast forward 4 years after 2010. I had just moved to Kansas City from D.C. to work in sports talk radio here. And we had Sporting Kansas City captain and U.S. men's national team defender. Matt Beisler was in studio with us. And I'll never forget his
Matt
answer.
Matt Beisler started for the U.S. team in 14.
Okay, so he was part of the team. And so that's why I think a lot of this conversation was surprising to me. Because after the World Cup, we had him in studio, and we asked him how long it would take for the U.S. to be contenders consistently at the World Cup level. And he said, and this stunned me, that it would take at least another 2 to 3 World Cups to even be a part of the conversation. And he sort of looked at it as a responsibility of him as far as being on that team to move that team forward to get to that next direction, almost as if they were laying the foundation. And I wonder if you see it in a similar type of timeline as he does.
I think that's a conversation for a completely different podcast, because I think you look at U.S. Soccer Federation development, Major League Soccer, the American player, the coach, all that, where the sport is. I see what Matt Beisler's point is. I mean, I think it's a very realistic viewpoint, too, because he came to your studio after the World Cup, which they got out of a group of death, so to speak,
right,
with Ghana, Germany, and Portugal in that group. So you would think there may be a more positive thing, but the reality is this, and this is what some, with the American sports fan that does not understand this at all, is how many countries have won the World Cup? You know, Ben, it's not like there's 20 countries that have won. You know, there's a reason why the powers that have won the World Cup. Now, ironically, in 2018, I bring this stat up, since 1958, every 20 years, a new country has won. And here we are, you're talking to me, England plays Croatia, so if Croatia beats England, that streak may continue. But it's not like we're talking about 20 teams at one. No. You know what I'm saying? So to be in the conversation of a contender to win a World Cup, Matt Beisler might have been too low on that. And ironically, here we are 4 years after that, they didn't even qualify. But that's also not to say that in 2022, the United States might not, not only will qualify, but they may get to the quarterfinal or semis. That's obviously possible as well. But so much around the World Cup, and I say this to all your listeners, is that it's one thing to get out of your group. It's another thing to the next level. And the difference between the Frances, the Brazils, the Germanys of the world, the Spains, is that they can get to another level out of the group stage. The United States, Mexico, Mexico's gotten out of the group 7 straight World Cup. They've lost in the round of 16,
right,
7 straight years. Now, people will criticize that, and I'll say, well, look at their opponents. How many of those were powerhouses? I think it's 5 of the 7, if not 6 of the 7. And you can make an argument that Bulgaria in 94 was legit, because that was their golden age. So this conversation of winning a World Cup, it's the whole point of it, of course. But that's a different conversation of just saying, how does the United States compete with the world elite? Remember, 4 years ago, Ben, we were having a conversation, can Jurgen Klinsmann get the United States,
that's right,
to compete against Belgium, Argentina, Colombia, Germany? Now you and I are having a conversation, how come they can't beat Trinidad?
Right. The narrative is constantly changing, and it's fascinating all the while. Do you remember, going back a little bit, who first made soccer important to you, and who did you first emulate when you were a player?
Well, my father played 10 years professional. His older brother played, I think, 3 years professional. And then his younger brother played, I think, 8 or 9 years. So I grew up in a soccer family, sports family. My grandfather played for the Yankees and all that. So I grew up as an American sports family. But soccer was because of my father. I'm the oldest. I've got a younger brother, younger sister. There's three of us. I was the oldest, so I went into the locker room. So it's a real easy answer for me. It was my father and just, you know, like any other son, trying to be like their dad. And, you know, fortunately for me, I'm still on that path, but, you know, I definitely I played the sport my father loved.
Well, it wasn't the only sport that you played, too. I think you were, what, a four-sport athlete in high school? Were there any other callings that you fell once the time came for you to make a decision? Were there any other heartstrings towards any other sports that you were considering?
Well, I went to Maryland on a baseball scholarship. So my senior year of high school, all the pre-draft stuff for Major League Baseball, I missed because I was playing with the under-17s. And I did a personal workout with the Kansas City Royals. And I think the Mets or Cardinals sent someone there as well. I was asked if I would have any interest in signing out of high school from the Kansas City Royals. And I said, wait, does that mean I got to give up soccer? And they said, yep. And that was the last time I ever touched a baseball.
Wow.
So
from that moment,
baseball was a huge part of it.
That's remarkable, especially having that conversation. It's funny, too, to have something like that where a professional opportunity is presented right in front of you for you to come to that moment and say, no, I would miss soccer too much. I think that was an eye-opening experience. It had to have been.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know at the time, you know, Ben. Like, I didn't know, like, I was making the decision for the rest of my life to play soccer. But I knew at some point I wanted to go to Maryland and still play soccer while also going to Maryland on a baseball scholarship. So I just, at the time, I didn't want to give up that opportunity. Now, ironically, I end up going to Maryland for two semesters and then turn pro soccer. But, you know, that day I didn't consciously say I'm going to play soccer and only soccer, but it foreshadowed where my heart really was.
Going from the transition of a player to a broadcaster, was it immediately natural for you, or was it something that you really had to work on over time?
Well, I still work on it. I think it's a part of the reason why I love what I do is there's a, you know, there's a craft to it, but it's also, I think, calling games is very unique. It's a challenge, and I love that part. It's very similar to, as a player, preparing each game and looking at it. Now, the difference is I don't ever win.
Right.
So no matter what you do as a color analyst, 50% of the time, people think you're an absolute idiot because their team's losing, which part of me loves that. You know, I love competing, but that's also part of me that struggles with that, Ben, if I'm honest. I hate the fact that I don't win a game. You know, I miss that part of it. I think you would have to ask my bosses that. I never said to anyone I wanted to do media, especially when I was playing. You know, I was the Bull Durham, gave every cliche answer, never wanted to leave myself or my teammates exposed if I really gave what I really wanted to say. You know, I tried to protect myself, not get in trouble, my family. And that was also during a different era. You know, if you think about it, 2008 compared to 2016, hot takes were awesome. There was no social media, you
right.
know, Instagram, Twitter, all that. I don't know if I would have been the guy that I was if I had Twitter and Instagram and the vehicle to actually be my own self.
That's,
you know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that's fascinating because I think as fans, we tend to look at the outspoken leaders in a particular sport and then all of a sudden say to themselves, man, that's somebody that you can really respect and appreciate in the booth. And if you were always so prepared for your answers, a lot of the times we'll say, well, you know, he's just saying what he needs to say. At some point, there had to be someone that saw more to you than just the cliched answers you were given. Was there somebody that said, hey, you know what? I think you could open up and really be good at this?
Yes, there was a gentleman by the name of Tom McNeely. He was here at ESPN, and he was producing many of the MLS games back in the day, and a lady by the name of Amy Rosenfeld. But Tom McNeely is the one that convinced me, and we had multiple beers together. We had great times together. I never knew what his job was, which is the hysterical part. I never knew he was in. I knew he worked at ESPN, but I didn't know what his job was, right? And it was right when I was dealing with my post-concussion syndrome, and he's like, you know, we should do media. And I laughed, and he did one of those, you know, like, no, I'm serious. Like, here's a game. You're going to do this game. And I'm like, no, I'm not, Tom. He's like, yeah, you're going to do it because you owe me one. And I did the game, and I called him. I apologized to him. I said, I'm so sorry. ESPN, that was easily the worst game that ever happened. And he said, we want you to do a couple more, and I've been here 8 years. So, people knew behind the scenes, Ben. I'm not going to sit here and say people knew that I, you know, had opinions and I was colorful and loud and obnoxious and all those adjectives you want to describe me for better or for worse, but I just wasn't going to do that as a player. You know, I'm a little old school in that. Should stay in the locker room, and I did it that way. But again, to your listeners, I'm not saying I would have done that in 16. I think I would have been forced to do it because, one, you make more money if you're more outspoken and be honest. I mean, look at the way social media is these days.
I think that's a really good point, but I think there's still an appreciation for honesty. I think there's a difference between hot take for the sake of hot take versus an honest opinion.
Well, Ben, that's actually a great point. And that's the one thing, because I think the next thing, sorry to interrupt you, but I think the next thing you're going to ask me is that, listen, I give my opinion. Obviously, anyone listening that's heard me, I've never shied away from that.
Right.
But the current players that I've still played, you know, my career ended very young, so I've still played with a lot of guys in the league. Coaches, played with, competed against, whatever that may be, they'll call me, text me, and say they disagree. But you'll never hear them say, they don't respect it.
Right.
Because they know I'm not going to say a hot take if I don't believe it. I'm not. I just can't. I can't do what some of the other media members do for a rile out of someone to, you know, just to get people fired. I can't do it. Because I know if I say something that I don't believe, somewhere down the road, I'm going to say the exact opposite, and someone's going to go, well, that was quick. And then all of a sudden, the viewer looks at you, or the listener says, oh, God, he's fraudulent.
Right. And then freezing cold takes will come after you.
But that will never be me. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to say I haven't had a hot take or an opinion about a player or a game, and that's completely backfired. I'm not saying I'm not wrong. But at least I'm giving my honest opinion. And it's something I believe as opposed to something I think that will, you know, benefit the quote-unquote profile of me just having a hot take to say I had a hot take.
On that subject, is there something in particular that you remember that you have changed your opinion about, something that you felt very strongly about during your time as an analyst that after more information or something else came out of the fold that you said, you know what, I was wrong and now I feel the other way about it?
I'll give you one recently. I think my initial take on Tim Tebow playing baseball was different than what it is now. I have a huge amount of respect because of playing multiple sports that Tim Tebow's, what he's doing right now is remarkable. But my initial take is I hate, and it still bothers me, when athletes say they can play other athletes' sports as if it's an easy shot in the dark breeze. Like,
right.
John Smoltz qualifying for the U.S. Senior Open,
yeah, it's insane.
He qualified. He earned it. He went through the process. You know, when other athletes, and I won't name names, but people listening can figure it out real quick, when they act as if they can play a sport so easily, I'm just like, you know what, you can't. Initially, my take on Tim Tebow was the Mets are doing it to sell tickets.
Right.
And listen, they're going to call him up because the Mets are awful and they're terrible, and they're going to call him up and people are going to buy tickets. But that shouldn't take away from what Tim Tebow's actually accomplished. The fact that he's hitting 250, the fact that he's actually done something after not playing baseball for X number of years, that's where my take changed a little bit, because I think people thought I was taking a shot at Tebow, and I was more just taking a shot at what I initially thought was, they're just trying to sell tickets.
You have a unique perspective, too, as someone who played four sports and playing soccer in an outstanding professional level while also going to Maryland on a baseball scholarship trying to hit a curveball. It's a very different type of thing. Hitting a major league pitch is one of the hardest things to do in all of sports.
Right, and Ben, I'll even double down. So for the listeners at home, my grandfather played pro baseball for 19 years, 11 in the majors. He won 2 World Series with the Yankees. I can go through all of his stats. The only thing he's remembered for was pitch running for the midget. And I say midget, obviously, I know the proper term is little person or whatnot. I'm not saying that. I just want to clarify that. But that's what the sales pitch that day was, being pinch run. You know, the midget was going to play, and his name was Eddie Goodell.
Right.
And I say that to you because the Tim Tebow thing, all this stuff, you know, whether it's Steph Curry playing in a PGA Tour web.com event, all that stuff, those are to sell tickets to draw eyes. I'm not saying it's right or wrong, but it doesn't mean I have to agree with it. So for me to go to Cooperstown, and the only thing my grandfather's remembered for is pinch running for Eddie Goodell, you follow where I'm going, and that was simply to sell tickets
right.
for the St. Louis Browns that day that were struggling. Yeah. Does that give any perspective or no?
No, absolutely.
I think it does.
Absolutely it does. I think sometimes it's easy to take something in a long and impressive career, and if something doesn't immediately stand out, you look to the most outrageous headline you can find. And unfortunately, for someone to celebrate it as your grandfather, a lot of the time from the mainstream side, it's going to come back to that headline.
Yeah, and that's just so. But that, you know, you asked me about a take that I've kind of, you know, you learn as you give these takes in certain things. Tim Tebow is the most recent example I can give you where I'm like, you know what? I don't know if I fully believe what I just said is actually true about Tim Tebow. And so, you know, that take changed, so to speak.
And I think as long as there's proper context behind your reasoning for changing your take, I'm never going to criticize anyone for doing a 180 is if they feel like they gain more information because of it. I think the goal in a lot of times in media is to both inform and entertain. And we know that the entertainment side is going to come forward, but if something else comes to light that makes you as a viewer smarter because something else were to be presented, I think it's disingenuous if you don't present the other side of it.
I agree. I think, Ben, my number one challenge, and this is where people, for whatever reason, I love my sport and I'll love it till the day I die, but I am not your typical soccer guy. And that's the one thing I think ESPN is finding out over the last couple, you know, 18, 19 months, so to speak, is that I did play baseball, you know, even though it's high school. I'm not saying I was a star, but I played at a high level.
Yeah.
And a lot of my friends right now play in the NFL, play in Major League Baseball. So, you know, the fact that, you know, I can play golf and I'm a scratch golfer, that kind of stuff. It's not to brag, but it's the kinds of conversations that you can ask me why Tiger Woods is going to a mallet putter, and I'll tell you, the British Open traditionally is slower greens, and the mallet putter is a little bit heavier. That's why he's going to it. And when I use that once on, you know, one of these ESPN shows, people are like, wait a minute. And then they, you know, they ask a couple people, and they're like, that's actually what golf is. Well, it doesn't hurt me that my uncle was on tour for 20 years. There's just kinds of
right.
conversation. So, Ben, my biggest challenge, and it still is and always will be, but I think it's starting to move, is that I can have a conversation about sports. I'm not your traditional, quote-unquote, soccer guy.
Yeah, and I think versatility is key, especially now. And somebody, too, that had maybe helped you along the way, somebody that has gotten rave reviews from American soccer viewers, was your partner Ian Dark, all throughout those years during the World Cup coverage. Is there something about Ian, the two of you working together, such a great conduit, such a good voice of the game, maybe that we as fans don't know about him?
Yeah, I mean, Ian Dark is a unique, I call him Mr. Belvedere. If you looked at his notes before the games, it looks like a mad scientist. The red light goes on, and all of that mumbo-jumbo unique way of putting together his thoughts comes out in an elegant way. I've enjoyed every single second with Ian, but I would say this to the listeners at home. I am extremely fortunate, even though my career ended at a very young age, I have gotten to work with some real seniority people. When you think about your first 4 years of a job and you work with Bob Lee, Mike Tirico, Ian Dark, you know, Adrian Healy, who's my partner on MLS games, doesn't get enough credit. How long has he been calling games? 15-plus years.
Yeah.
So for me, JP Della Camera was my first year with the Philadelphia Union. So, Ben, when I looked at it, I really looked at my first contract here at ESPN, one, to see if I really wanted to do it, but two, like an internship. I called games my first year with 8 different partners. That was extremely invaluable because I don't know how to describe why, but basically is that was 8 different ways to see a game, call a game.
No doubt.
So for me, and then 2 years later, I'm working with John Champion, and then I work with Derek Ray. So I think I've called games, I think, with 12, 13 people, and it makes you better. It challenges the heck out of you. But to sit here and tell you that off the camera, my time with Ian hasn't been anything but special. I'd be lying to you. I enjoy every second of it. I look at him as a, you know, he's a friend, but he's also a mentor. He's always been there to tell me, you know what, this is good, this isn't good. You know, he gives advice, as all of those guys, you know, Mike Tirico, Bob Lee, John Champion, to a certain extent, have always been there to say, you know what, because I ask questions. And the one thing, Ben, that I thrive on, that I like criticism. Not Twitter kind of criticism.
Right.
I'm not going to say I love Twitter criticism. Sometimes a waste of time. But when when your bosses or other people that have been doing this way longer than you give you constructive criticism, it's like being a player. I love that.
Speaking and having 7-8 years in radio, I'm completely with you. It was one of the things that you wish for constantly, to have constructive criticism, to have feedback, to have somebody listen to something that you've done and say, yeah, this worked, or this was terrible, or this is what I would change about it. Anything besides you suck or that was amazing, because that doesn't really help you in the end.
No, and listen, I don't care about Twitter criticism if it's you suck or whatnot, but I think what
helpful.
People don't realize is that, well, yeah, and I've always wondered, well, okay.
Yeah,
like,
thanks.
It took you that amount of time to write that, so that becomes interesting. But, like, when he was also part of me that loved that dude. I loved walking into a stadium and being booed. I love that. One, that means you're doing something right.
Right.
And two, that means their fans are engaged. Their fans care. Like, living in the Northeast, for a majority of my life, the professional life, there's nothing better than that. You know, knowing that the opposition and those fans and everybody hates your guts because you're wearing different colors and that kind of stuff, or you're the goal scorer for the other team, whatever it is, I love that.
Before we wrap things up, and I really do appreciate your time, Taylor, this has been a lot of fun. I think what you're doing with the Think Taylor Foundation in the form of education on head injuries, concussions, subtraumatic brain injuries, I think it's immensely important, and not just for soccer, but across all sports. I know it was part of your reasoning for retiring, but before we dive in a little bit further, can you tell us more about the awareness your foundation has been able to cause because of what you're doing?
Yeah, it was the only reason I retired, and unfortunately at 28, none of us ever think it's going to be over that quickly, but unfortunately my decision was made for me. Basically, we've raised so much awareness that U.S. Soccer Foundation, you know, the U.S. Soccer Federation, last year, we had every single Development Academy boys and girls take a TT pledge, and the TT pledge is, I pledge to be educated, I pledge to be honest, and I pledge to be supportive. What I'm trying to change is the narrative around the injury. You know, it's an evolving injury, whether education and research and whatnot. So when I started the foundation, it was more important for me to raise awareness that the injury is real. It's not just an NFL, American football problem, cheerleading, a question, no matter what you're doing. It's a health problem, and everyone needs to be educated because, in my opinion, if the American public, and quite honestly, public in general, is more educated, they're going to make better decisions. A lot less people smoke because they were properly educated about smoking causing cancer. Now, do people still smoke then? Yes, of course. But at least you're giving the public the answers and the science, and then they can make their decision, but then they can't claim what I claim, and I'm right. In 2008, I didn't have any of this. We didn't have the protocols, and even the protocols now are still flawed.
Right.
We're still making bad decisions, but that's a bad, different discussion. But at least give everyone the answers, especially parents and kids, because the kids are the innocent ones. And if the kids are educated, by the time they're my age, they're going to make better decisions than I did. So in due time, I firmly believe this. And the reason why I've looked at soccer and soccer in general is because I get girls and boys. You know, if I just looked at ice hockey or I just looked at football, your majority is going to be the boys.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, the sport of soccer, I can educate the masses a lot quicker.
No doubt. And I think the educational component to it is so critical. And it's part of what you're seeing from so many other, both current and former athletes on this discussion. Dan Carcillo is somebody that's been doing a lot of work with the Players Tribune on the NHL side, who feels like the league is fighting against information. And that's all they really wanted in the process, was just know the risks, know what you were getting yourself into, present it and say, okay, now that you have the facts, you can make your own informed opinions. The NFL just, an attempt to settle a lawsuit in the billions with regards to the lack of information. And that lack of information is passed down generationally. And until more information comes out from the parent side, like you said, it's going to be this constant battle. So I think just presenting as much information to the public as you can is doing quite a service. So I really admire you for that.
Thanks, Ben. I appreciate it.
Is there a way, I sort of look at football and maybe in a selfish fashion, I say to myself, there's not really a way that you can change football to make it more safe. I just think football in and of itself is, it's a rough sport. It's a dangerous, violent sport. Hockey, maybe you can change a couple areas to get rid of some checking and make it more like Olympic style, and maybe you're going to be a little bit better, but it's still a dangerous sport. Can soccer evolve? Can soccer become less dangerous and less likely to deal with a lot of these subconcussive hits over time? Is there a way to fix it?
I think if you evolve, especially at the younger ages, and limit the amount of exposure they have to heading the ball and collisions in the air, then the answer is yes. But I don't think you're going to ever get FIFA to outlaw heading. I just don't see them doing that. And quite honestly, I'm not waiting for FIFA to do anything. But right. I think if you can evolve the youth games, you still give the kids an opportunity to fully grow health-wise while also teaching the sport. It's not as if soccer completely dies if you don't head a ball under the age of 12. And anyone that is listening tells me I'm wrong. Go watch an under 12, under 11, under 10, under 9 game. They don't head the ball until coaches tell them to.
Right.
So the natural reaction isn't to head a ball. So you can easily change it. It's just a matter of not whether or not you want to evolve and be proactive doing it.
Taylor, I've really enjoyed talking to you today. Really appreciate your time and your candor. So thanks so much for joining us on the podcast.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Ben. Talk to you soon.
My thanks to Taylor Twellman for hopping by today on the Awful Announcing podcast presented by Clip It. We'll be back in a couple weeks, taking a little bit of travel time, and then be back with a roundtable most likely at the end of July. Be sure to follow us at Awful Announcing on Twitter to get a chance to play in our game for your chance to win $50 to Amazon.com, as well as for all the links and all the stories and interaction on social media as well. Thank you guys so much for listening. Big thanks to Taylor Twellman of ESPN for stopping by. My name is Ben Heisler. We will talk to you guys again in a couple weeks right here on the Awful Announcing podcast.